Hello, everybody, and welcome to Coast to Cast, a podcast on coastal science, where we meet scientists and ask questions that don't usually appear in published papers. My name is Giovanni Coco, and today I have the pleasure to be with Professor Simon Mudd. He will tell us where he's from, and he will tell us how he finally arrived at the University of Edinburgh, where he's been for quite a while. Simon will tell us about his trajectory, but I will tell you that he's an amazing geomorphologist. In fact, he's a quantitative geomorphologist. He has quite a diverse life in terms of research. He works on mountain, hill slopes, coastal environments, primarily marsh settings. Well, at least that's what I know. And combines, that's the most interesting part, that when a paper from Simon Mudd comes out, you never know if it's theory, if it's numerical modeling, if it's some crazy field experiment. Very interesting research, definitely someone I wanted to interview. And also, I have to say that while looking at his website, very nice website, I suggest to go and have a look. I noticed that he also shares software to analyze topography, and the name of the software is definitely worth a visit to the website. He will tell us about that too, I'm sure. Hello, Simon. Welcome to Coast to Cast. And thanks for taking the time to join us and answer some questions.
Hello. Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm very pleased to be here.
Let's get started. How did you end up in Edinburgh, and how did you start in general in geomorphology?
How did I end up in Edinburgh? Well, I needed a job. So I applied to jobs. And this was the one that I got.
And where were you before?
Yeah. So I did a bachelor's degree at Berkeley, and I became a geomorphologist because I took Bill Dietrich's geomorphology class. And I think I always was a geomorphologist at heart, and I didn't realize it until I took Bill's class. So when I was a kid, we moved when I was about, I would have been 14 or something, to Riverside. So I was born in Riverside, and then we spent a little while in Northern California, and then we moved back when I was about 14 to Riverside. And we bought this house that was there was no garden. It was in the middle of the desert. And I used to have this hose from the house, and I would just run the hose on the desert and watch the patterns that it made as it formed tiny little channels. And my mother would get really angry with me, because if you're living in the desert, you're not supposed to run a hose for an hour. We were supposed to conserve water, but I didn't do that. I was looking at the patterns. So, you know, from 14,
and then
Bill
Dietrich's class inspired you.
Yeah. So I did a geology degree, and I like geology now, but I think I was looking. So I'd started, I'd taken a lot of math and physics courses, and I liked the quantitative side of it. And geology was very, geology is a quantitative field, but a lot of the undergraduate courses, it's a lot of looking at minerals and there was a lot of memorization, and I was getting a bit fed up. And then I took Bill's class, and it was like calculus and how to quantify what the surface of the earth, and you could use some equations to tell you why hilltops were round and stuff like that. And I just thought it was amazing, and I knew I wanted to do that for my life. So
that's fantastic. That's what
got me started. Yeah.
Oh, we have great. To say thanks to Bill.
Course. Yeah. Well, he's done that for a lot of people. people I was undergraduate with are now professors of geomorphology, and they all had the same experience. So it was really a great class. Very difficult. He made us work hard.
Okay,
so
but
there was a kind of a bimodal opinion about that course. People who didn't really end up liking geomorphology thought it was the worst course they took at university because it was so much work. But for me, I thought it was just great.
So let's continue with your path towards Edinburgh.
Yeah, and then I signed up for a master's degree in Santa Barbara for all the wrong reasons. I knew I wanted to do geomorphology, but I ended, life happened, and I applied to go to Santa Barbara. And I got there and I didn't really quite know. I wanted to work with Tom Dunn. And I went to Tom, so I emailed him. I had gotten a kind of scholarship before I had a supervisor. And I emailed Tom Dunn and I said, I'm really interested in your group and working with you. And he said, I've got too many students. I don't have any space. Like a one line email. And I just ended up kind of, so I searched around for a supervisor and I kind of knew after talking to Tom for 5 minutes, I wanted to work with him. So I just ended up sort of hanging around in his lab until I sort of became his student without him ever really agreeing to it. And Santa Barbara later became this huge kind of, I mean, so Doug Burbank came after I had been there and a few other people who had moved there later. But at the time, you know, I basically just sat in the lab until he took me as a student. So when I was there, I did a kind of hydrology master's. My master's ended up being about floods in ephemeral channels. So I chased flash floods in Los Alamos, New Mexico, which was pretty wild because September 11th, 9/11 happened while I was in Los Alamos. Los Alamos is a national laboratory where they do nuclear weapons research. So this happened and I didn't have a television. So I only heard it happening on the radio and I had no, unless you see the images of it, you don't kind of, you know, it's that someone on the radio says, oh, an airplane has flown into a building. And then a little while later, oh, the building fell down. And it just on the radio, you don't have no idea of what's really happened. And so I was working in the library trying to work on this master's thesis. And I just thought, oh, well, that's interesting. Anyway, I'm going to go to the library now. And I went to the library. And the whole lab had these metal shutters that closed over the windows of the lab. And then I got to the car park of the library and there were these Marines with, you know, machine guns. And I pull up to the library and they say, what are you doing here? And I said, I just want to go to the library and read about hydraulics. And they said, you need to get out of here before we shoot you. Yeah, it was a very strange time. So then I did that. I got a master's degree. I decided to move away from Santa Barbara and I was looking at supervisors and I had a few choices, a few people whose papers I really thought were interesting, but I decided to contact David Furbish. He was receptive. So I think that in Tom's group, because Tom had already sort of spent all of his research money, he had the students there and I forced my way into that lab really. But I was the black sheep. I was there just because I was persistent, not because I was recruited into that lab. And I thought, well, how am I going to get recruited into someone's lab so that they will actually want me to be there? And I thought that geomorphologists with quantitative skills seemed to be in demand. So I learned how to code. And I also, I took a really inspiring course. The two best courses I took in my life were Bill Dietrich's geomorphology course and a fluid dynamics course at Santa Barbara, which was run by the mechanical engineering department. And it was a guy by the name of Ted Bennett who taught that course. And I'm not even sure what his research, I could look that up now, but I think he did like sort of fluid mechanics of manufacturing processes and stuff like that. Like, you know, how to coat things. You put a liquid onto something and you need to coat it and think, you know, very engineering stuff. But he taught this fluid mechanics class that was just amazing. Every lecture you started by re-deriving the Navier-Stokes equations. And then applying it to a specific problem. So I can't do it now, but every day, every lecture in class, you would re-derive from conservation of mass and momentum, Navier-Stokes. And it was three quarters of that. So basically it was a year of that course. And it was just amazing. And it actually, the other thing about that course, so it started with fluid situations that you could get analytical solutions for. And then eventually the governing equations got too complex. So we needed to start with numerical solutions. And he started by giving us bits of code. And then eventually we had to write our own code. And by the end of this year of fluid mechanics, we were writing code in C for turbulent flow. That is the best course I've ever taken in my life. It was just incredible, life-changing. But at the same time in Tom's lab, Manny Gabay was there, and we are still best of friends. And he also was writing code. So he taught me a lot about how to write certain bits of code. And I also had been looking at this numerical model called CHILD, which is a landscape evolution model. And that was written by Greg Tucker and Nicole Gasparini and Stephen Lancaster. And I started studying that code as well. So through those three avenues, I learned how to code. And once I knew how to do that, then I approached David and I said, hey, I can write some code. Would you like a PhD student who can write code? And he said, yes. So I ended up for a little while at Florida State, where David was at the time. And then he moved to Vanderbilt University. So I moved with him. So halfway through my PhD, I moved from Florida State to Vanderbilt just to follow David.
Next step was Edinburgh or some other stop in between?
Well, I got my PhD and my at Vanderbilt, and my PhD was about hill slope geomorphology. But while this sort of kicked off in Florida State, so while I was at Florida State, David was there. Mark Schmeckley was there, who does turbulent sediment transport. He left to go to Arizona State. And Sergio Fagarazzi was there. Initially, David had written some proposals about biota and sediment transport feedbacks, and NSF somehow put him in contact with another similar proposal, which was led by Jim Morris. And so David and Jim Morris, I'm not quite sure if they independently contacted each other or if NSF sort of said, hey, the two of you need to get together, or how that happened. But anyway, Jim ended up in Tallahassee, and he sort of sat in our lab, and we got to talking, and he started talking about his famous marsh organ experiments. So this would have been in 2001. I started talking to Jim, and we went out on the marsh together, and I never thought of doing coastal stuff. But then I realized what he was doing was amenable to numerical simulation. So that kicked off a kind of collaboration, which lasted through. So while I was doing this hill slope PhD, I was also continuing to talk to Jim, and David was involved in that. And then there was another PhD student, Susan Howell, who was at Vanderbilt at the time, and we carried on working on that. So that ended up being the early coastal papers that I wrote, which basically plugged in Jim's biomass models into some sediment transport models. And it was, I mean, from a geomorphologist to understand what an ecologist was saying and speaking the same language, it took about 2 years before we could actually understand what we were saying to each other. When I realized what data Jim had at that, so they've got that LTER, long-term ecological research station. And they, even at that time in 2003-04, they had 15 or 20 years of really intensively measured plant characteristics. So they had been fertilizing plots and not fertilizing them as a control. And they had all these non-invasive ways to get all the information about the plants. So they had stem densities, they had stem heights, they had the stem diameters, they had the biomass, they had all this stuff. And they were taking those measurements monthly. And I realized that, because I had also looked at the papers that Heidi Knepf had written about what's happening in lab experiments. And I thought, oh, I can actually use this data to, this could go into some of those models of particle capture and turbulence and all that stuff. So I just, it was, you know, it kind of fell into my lap almost, that data set. And I just tried to map, I tried to map on what Jim and his team had measured with the models that were mostly coming out of MIT at the time. So those were those initial coastal papers. And so one came out in 2000, the first paper came out in 2004. And then after I finished my PhD, David got and asked me to contribute a little bit to writing a grant that ended up getting funded by NOAA. And so for a year after my PhD, I stayed at Vanderbilt working on that coastal stuff. So that was about, that was, we were working in North Carolina on the marshes there. So I spent a year working. I mean, it was mainly numerical modeling stuff, but we did go out and try to get boats out on marshes and do things like get stuck in the mud and things.
all of this was even before the paper by Kirwan and Murray, because they actually probably used some of your data.
I don't know if they use my data or not. I can't remember. We were talking to them because David and Peter Half, who is at Duke, are really good friends. So we would go, and David's actually from that part of North Carolina. So we would go. I think I went a couple of times to Duke with David just to visit, and we would, you know, stay around, hang out with Peter and go swimming in his pool and that sort of thing. And Matt was there at the time, and Brad Murray was there. So we were talking with them, and Brad Murray and Matt were also talking to Jim Morris at the time. So all that was happening at that time around 2002, 2003, 2004. So I had spoken to Matt. I knew Matt kind of a couple of years before that first paper was published. So we had, you know, that group of PhD students knew each other just because the Vanderbilt people would go with David to visit Duke and talk to each other. And I think there might have been one workshop. So North Carolina, I'm trying to remember what the name of this place was, so North Carolina had a kind of research station on the coast that we ended up at a few times, and we would go and hang about on salt marshes. I was there with Matt at one stage. I can't quite remember. It's a long time ago.
But you're still in the States, not in Edinburgh. So we're still missing some parts.
So then, while I was doing that postdoc, I mean, my wife was pregnant, and I needed a job. So I started applying. In 2006, I realized, oh, I can actually finish this PhD. So I started applying for jobs in 2006, and I didn't get any faculty positions. And then I got that postdoc. And then my wife was pregnant, and it's like, well, you need to get a job now. So I applied to places, and these two jobs in Scotland came up. And I said to my wife, well, what do you think about Scotland? And she said, no way. Not a chance. But so my father's from North England, and I'd been there a lot. And I basically sold this as, well, I'm just going to go over there, get a free trip, and I can see my aunt and uncle. Which I did. So I interviewed at Glasgow and Edinburgh, and I saw my aunt and uncle. And then a couple of months later, about a month later, they offer me the job, which is a bit. So in the UK is very strange with the way they interview people. I mean, in the US, they do that. It's this grueling 48-hour thing, and they have one candidate in at a time, and the whole process lasts a month, and then they take another month. Whereas the UK, everybody comes in at the same time. And then you go into a kind of formal interview where they ask you things like, where do you see yourself in 5 years? And, you know, these crazy questions. And then they frequently will appoint the person that night. But in my case, one of the candidates who, this is actually Mikhail, who also got a job. But at the time, he was in that candidate pool. So we both got kind of the job at the same time. But there had been a medical emergency, and he basically couldn't go to the, so his partner had a kind of medical emergency, and he couldn't go to the interview. So they postponed the interview for him, and we waited a kind of extra month. And then after this extra month, they said, they contacted me and said, you've got the job. And it was a bit awkward because the timing of hiring in the UK is different from the US. So they offered me this job before the US process had run its course. And I had to have very long conversations with my wife about, like, are we going to do this? Because basically it's either take this job or have some interviews in the States. I have no idea if I'm going to get them. And then I had been, I don't want to really disparage anywhere, but I had an interview at Texas A&M, and it's sort of like, we don't know if I would get that job anyway. And would you rather live in Edinburgh or College Station, Texas? I'm sure College Station, Texas is lovely, but Edinburgh is really a kind of fairy tale city. So I knew what I wanted to do. Yeah.
That's a fantastic journey, and also leads this final part to a classic question. As I told you, we will mix science question and non-science question. So the next one is a non-science one. How do you balance your personal life and academic work?
Oh, yeah. I don't know. I try to keep a good work-life balance. I try not to work on the weekends, spend time with my kids.
How old are they?
So my son is 16 and my daughter's 12.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, life's too short to work all weekend. Come on.
Definitely. Definitely. What are your interests out of work?
So I go hill walking. I like to cycle, snorkeling, outdoor things. I like doing outdoor things. I like going to the beach and swimming in rivers and things. I mean,
single
Scotland
malls,
is
have become also an interest since you moved to Edinburgh.
They are. I don't have a high tolerance. I can only have one glass, but it's delicious. Yeah. And when I moved to the UK, the pound was very strong. It was £2 or $2 to the pound. And everything just seemed super expensive. But if you went into a pub, they would have a malt of the moment, and it was usually a bottle of whiskey that was nearly finished. And so they just needed to get rid of it. So they would sell that. And every pub in Scotland's like this. You go in, they'll have a malt of the moment. They might not call it malt of the moment, but they usually do. And you'll get a dram. At that time, it was £2 for a dram of single malt, 12-year-old whiskey. And at exactly the same time in the States, if you were to order that, it would have been $10. And I just thought it was the only thing that was less expensive in the UK than in the United States. The only thing. That's not true anymore. But so you go in and you just think, well, you've got this amazing substance if you're into that kind of thing, and you're only paying £2 or £2.50 for it. So I sampled many.
So let's go back to science now. What do you think of our ability to predict long-term coastal morphodynamics? We run our models, our numerical models. Sometimes we run them until the famous 2100. Does it make sense? Should we trust those predictions? Should we make them?
Yeah, I think that it depends on where you are in the system. I feel like in estuaries, you don't know if this one stretch of coast is going to advance by 10 meters or not. But I do think on large scale estuaries, there's a mass balance issue. So I think in terms of projecting, well, if you've got this kind of sediment flux from the mountains, and you sort of know what the compaction rates are, and you know what the isostatic rebound is, you know what the sea level is, you kind of know what the accommodation space is going to be for your estuary, you can probably get a pretty good idea of how much that, your marsh is going to expand or contract. I've been quite impressed by, the beach modeling, the sand spits and things. Those models seem to do pretty well. And it seems like we're not bad at being or simulating sand moving around from place to place. But in those cases, the wave climate plays a big role, which we don't know. The climate models, the really accurate climate models aren't going to tell you what the wave climate's going to be like in 2100, or at least I don't think they will. So I think that's a more difficult problem. In places where you've got hard coast erosion or cliff retreat and things like that, that's much harder. So I work in the uplands. A lot of, probably more than half of what I do is in mountain terrains, and you might have a landslide somewhere. You know that when it rains heavily, you will have landslides following some statistical distribution. You know that that will happen, but where they're going to be is anybody. I mean, I don't think we are able to specifically say the spatial distribution of the, we can get a statistical idea of what's going to happen. But
we cannot say, obviously, this position here will move backwards or forwards of 20 meters. I mean, we can just probably make broader scenario type of predictions, I guess. That's what you're saying. Yeah.
And I also think another issue with a lot of coastlines. So in Scotland, we have coastlines that prograded during the glacial period, or some of them. We're actually quite lucky in Scotland for climate change, because Scotland is, so it used to be completely popping out of the ocean because of isostatic rebound. It's now, sea level has kind of caught up to that process, but we're still very healthy in terms of our relative rate of sea level rise. But there are parts of Scotland where you've got a low coast, and we have links where golf was developed. So you've got these dune systems along the beach, which are apparently brilliant for golf. I don't play golf myself, but so I've heard. And there are points in which, so behind the dunes, you can have lower lying land, and occasionally those get breached during storms. And there's this very fine balance between, is the storm going to breach the dune and flood the hinterland? And if you flood the hinterland, you make all these ecological changes, which could result in a sort of tipping point process. Predicting that is really a challenge. Yeah.
What about your favorite paper, or a paper that changed your approach to science? You mentioned two courses that were really important, but is there also a paper that comes to mind?
There's the whole series of papers that really introduced quantitative thinking to different parts of geomorphology. So in coastal science, that the French papers were really influential to me. So for me, the most important paper ever is not a coastal paper, but it's G.K. Gilbert's Geology of the Henry Mountains. Because in 1889, you get this very modern approach to geomorphology, which didn't really get picked up in a widespread way until the 50s again. So the sort of William Morris Davis school dominated through the sort of 20s, 30s, 40s. And then you ended up with Gilbert, I don't know if you've read that paper, but yes. I think anyone who's a geomorphologist, even if you're a coastal scientist, you should have a look at that paper, because it's very modern in the way it approaches landscapes. It's thinking about mass balance and fluxes. And I think that's the big tool. That's our big tool, really. Keeping track of where the sediment is. Bill gives talks, or he might not do this anymore, but he used to give talks, and he would say all of geomorphology in one equation, and it would basically be a mass conservation equation with the flux term in it. And that's all of geomorphology in one equation. And I think that's true for most of the subdisciplines of geomorphology. So that paper is really influential for me. I read it every 2 years. I reread that paper just to get inspired. Yeah. And other papers that were really influential were Mike Kirkby's Hill Slope Form and Process. Again, even if you're not a hill slope geomorphologist, it's just the way of thinking about landscapes, and you make observations of what you see, and you think, how can I try and quantify what's happening here? What are the processes that are shaping the landscape and that way of thinking? And Mike was able to do that in those papers very early on. Yeah, the kind of Stan Shum school, Marie Morisawa's 1962 paper about, so that was the first paper that really looked at power law relationships between drainage area and slope. A lot of people, so in upland landscapes, they call that relationship Flint's Law after a paper that was in 1974, but actually Marie Morisawa did that in 62. So it should be called Morisawa's Law. So that, yeah, I like those early quantitative papers where they took something that had been approached qualitatively and then tried to come up with a governing, you know, system of governing equations. Those are really inspirational to me, those papers.
Because they really changed the way we do geomorphology, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was Alan Howard's early paper. Well, Alan Howard wrote a lot of great papers, but on lots of different things. Well, he's another inspiration to me. I mean, he didn't stick to one area. He's done a lot of work on meandering and Martian landscapes and continental scale river erosion. And yeah, that body of work is quite amazing.
I noticed you work with a lot of scientists worldwide. Tell us about the importance of collaborations in your research.
Well, I would say that it's quite easy to get stuck in a rut about how you think about scientific problems. And different fields have very different ways of addressing scientific problems and the tools that they have at their disposal. And that cross-pollination is really a way to inspire new thinking. Speaking to Jim Morris was, when you have to try and understand how an ecologist thinks, it puts you in a very different frame of mind than when you're speaking to geomorphologists or scientists. And they've got a intellectual tradition that is not the same as ours. And so you can get a lot of new ideas from that. And I also think going to different parts of the world. So another series of papers that I thought were quite inspiring were Kerry Lee Rogers' papers about kind of global carbon accumulation. And I remember, so there was this amazing paper. She had one of the first figures was about the global isostatic response and the difference between the Northern Hemisphere, where you have a very different time series of sea level than you do in Australia and at lower latitudes. And it just, I mean, I think this makes me sound really naive, but if you worked your whole life in the Northern Hemisphere and at higher latitudes, you just sort of think, oh yeah, the Holocene, you have these big sea level changes. And especially even if you're working in North America or the UK, you have these big changes in relative sea level where the sea level's dropping quite quickly and that sort of, and you just think, well, that's the way the world works. And and then someone from Australia says, well, that's not what happened here at all. I mean, again, it makes me sound a bit naive, but it's really, you think, oh, wait, oh, hold on. That's really different. And I also working with Chinese colleagues, you've got a very different looking coastline. They've got a very different sediment flux story than we do. Like in North, in the UK and the Netherlands, there's just not, there's not a huge sediment flux story going on there. So you need, if you want to think about that, you need to go to places that have these big sediment fluxes and talk to people who have thought about that for a long time. So that collaboration is really useful just to get different perspectives on how the planet works. So I think it's essential.
Tell us a research topic that's really exciting you at the moment, something you're working on and you want to share with our listeners.
Well, it's not. So right now I'm not doing, I don't have a big coastal project at the moment. We're sort of looking at trying to better constrain where rivers are going, which sounds like, well, don't we already know that? But I just the remote sensing data products that we can now get are mind-blowing to me. And everybody's using Google Earth Engine now, but maybe if you're doing your PhD now, that seems just completely routine. But the fact that we're imaging, I mean, we have some access to Planet Labs data, and you can image the whole surface of the Earth at kind of a couple meter resolution every day. I mean, the idea that you could do that when I was doing my PhD was just, it was out of this world. You couldn't. So, I mean, imagine if you can, well, this is what we're trying, if you can use new tools, like if you had to digitize every river in the world every day, you couldn't do it by hand, right? You could do once a year for 10 years in a small part of the Amazon, let's say. But algorithmically, you can get quite a lot of it, and there's bits that the algorithms struggle with. So then we've got machine learning and AI that does a little bit of a better job. So it is now plausible to have daily land cover classifications if you wanted to. It's just you're limited by the compute power, but it's possible to do it. So if you're interested in, I mean, this applies to coastal change. We're looking at river migration, or you could do landsliding or any of those problems. We now can get global data sets, and you can start testing theories about, well, how does vegetation affect the meander rate? How does sediment flux affect the meander rate? But you're not just doing a site, you're doing every river on the planet. So we had a recent paper where we looked at junction angles, and we were trying to explain. So people had previous authors, for example, Jim Kirshner and colleagues had looked at climate controls on junction angles. And there were some really amazing papers that came out a few years ago trying to explain the equilibrium junction angle of two rivers coming together. And they ended up with this kind of 72 degrees should be the optimal angle. And then there was a kind of larger analysis of junction angles and looking at the climate control on that. So they found a climate control, and we went in to try and explain something about that climate control. So we had a paper published in 2023 about that. But doing that, you can extract every river junction on the planet and then process that data and test it against theory. So
is it 72 degrees?
No, it's not. It's close-ish to 72 degrees in temperate landscapes, and then it gets narrower when it gets more arid. So we didn't find that. That was the earlier papers. But we can kind of explain some of that variability on the basis of, well, this gets a bit technical, but on the basis of what we think is called the concavity index of the channel. So basically how much steeper a channel gets as you move downstream can be quantified by something called the concavity index. And that actually, depending on the two sizes of the rivers, what that concavity index is will actually have some control over what the junction angle is. It has to do with optimality, and you should read the paper.
I will. I promise I will.
Yeah.
Non-science question. Best or worst advice you ever received?
That's a difficult one. There are a lot of great scientists out there that, they work at a small university. They might publish a paper once every other year, but those papers are cracking good. And I actually, you need to try and find those papers, because there's a kind of visit. I feel like, well, one bit of advice. There's a bit of a visibility. I think as a scientist, you want to try and get your ideas out there. I mean, we spend a lot of time working on papers. It's very hard to get to do a good paper. It really involves a tremendous amount of effort. I mean, for my first author papers, that's kind of 2 years of effort. that you put into it. And so, of course, you want people to read it. If you want people to, it's, people don't just find papers randomly, I think. You kind of need to go to those conferences and sort of chat about it so that when your paper comes out, especially if you're presenting before the paper comes out, people know that you're working on that. So they actually look for, they see that that paper's come out and they actually think, oh, I remember hearing about that at the conference. That was a kind of interesting talk. And they read the paper. So I do think, I mean, it makes it sound a little bit like a popularity contest. I mean, I do think you can't just passively expect people to read your good stuff. You have to kind of go out and make sure people know about it. And there's a lot of really great papers that aren't well cited. Absolutely. You know, and you know, that could be a criticism of the field, but at this stage of my career, I can't read 100 papers a week or however many that are coming out. So that kind of promotion is important if you want people to read your paper. My other advice is this should be fun. I think being a scientist, we're not going to get rich doing this. So if it's not fun, why are you doing it? And the key to having fun is to work with great people you like. So find collaborators you like, you enjoy working with, and your life will be so much better. So, I mean, yeah, don't, even if someone's hyper productive or something, you think, oh, it'd be good to work with them. You know, if they're a jerk, don't work with them ever. Life is too short to work.
I think this is the best advice we had on this podcast by a long shot. I think we are getting close to the end of our conversation, but I have a few quick questions. Tell us about your favorite band, type of music, or composer. What do you listen to?
I go through a lot of genres. So I played trumpet as a young man. So I got into jazz. I like jazz. I like those old trumpet players like Horace Silver and stuff like that. Dirty Dozen Brass Band. I like that kind of Afrobeat stuff. Just like the horns are really nice. But I also like kind of hard rock music. My formative years were in the sort of early 90s. So all of those bands that came out around that time, so the first time I ever heard Rage Against the Machine's Killing in the Name Of, was in a van on my way to Lollapalooza with my mates, and they were opening the concert. So you hear this music, which is really potent if you like that sort of thing, and you just think, this is the greatest tune I've ever heard in my life. And then 5 hours later, you're watching them play that live. It was pretty amazing. In terms of that kind of music, I like there's a band called Clutch, which is a sort of bluesy rock band. The only reason I know about this band is I was in the record shop, and on the back of the record, the lead singer was wearing a t-shirt for the Riverside International Speedway, which is my hometown is Riverside. So I just thought, oh, this Speedway. So I bought the album, and I love that band. Yeah, I like the old progressive rock band. I like Rush. I try to explain to my children how great Neil Peart is as a drummer. I like sort of 90s rap music as well. But yeah, I don't know. I like to listen to a lot of different stuff.
What about your favorite dish? Or if you cook, do you have a signature dish?
Well, we just bought an air fryer. So I've been making a lot of French fries. We vary it a lot. I did a sabbatical in Italy, and I love Italian food. You know, pretty much anything that comes. You go and
where did you go?
Go to Italy? So I was in Padova for 8 months,
of course,
and it was just paradise. I mean, it wasn't even. You can go to a restaurant; it was amazing. But so in Padova, you must have been to Padova a few times.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Did you go to La Folpetta in the in the market
I
there.
Remember, probably.
It's a marquee or a kind of tent. La folpetta is the Venetian word for pulpo. It's an octopus tent. And they prepare them. They're all fresh, and they also do these fish stew type, not a stew. I mean, it's almost like a ceviche thing. And they've just got it in this sauce that is unbelievable. And you can buy those things. You get it with this bread. It's in the sauce. You can dip it in the sauce. It's kind of a very nice olive oil with garlic and some other herb that's beautiful. And you have it. You get the seafood, and then you can go next door. You can buy wine next door and sit at their tables. And they also have the that kind of pork they make. And I don't know if they have this in southern Italy, but in northern Italy they have this pork where it's slow cooked, and they have rosemary laced through the whole thing.
Oh,
that's very, very nice. Very, if you ever go there, go get some of that. The recent thing I had that was amazing was we did some field work north of Xi'an in the Lus Plateau, and the noodles there are just incredible. So it's wheat-based noodles. It must have been where, you know, so that was the end of the Silk Road. And I mean, that must be where Italy got the concept of these wheat noodles from. And the ones near Xi'an are they make them from the dough there right before they serve them to you. And they're all very thick, they're thick wheat noodles. And they put some kind of combination of spices on it that's amazing. And they use kind of Szechuan pepper, and it's just incredible. I didn't have a bad meal. I was there for a week, and every meal was spectacular.
Latest book you read?
Well, I'm reading something kind of embarrassing. I don't want to tell you it.
Tell us a book you read that doesn't embarrass you.
It's a cheesy fantasy thing. I was watching the Wheel of Time thing on Amazon, so I decided to read the book. I'm partial to silly fantasy and science fiction books. I've read every Ian M. Banks. I don't know if you know this author. Yeah. Ian M. Banks. He was a Scottish author. He writes literature under the name Ian Banks and science fiction under the name Ian M. Banks. And I think I've read every single one of those books about six times. Yeah. When I saw you in China, I had bought a Murakami book at the airport. It was quite good. Commandante or something like that. Anyway, I like those. Anyway, any science fiction, I'll devour it.
What about your favorite movie?
I quite like Sicario. Maybe it's Denis Villeneuve. I've mispronounced that. I don't know exactly how to pronounce that name. But anyway, his films are great. I like those kind of films where, so I do, I watch, my consumption of media is sort of, I like fantasy and science fiction. I like stupid action films. But I also, I like films with sort of slow pace sometimes as well. And those films, like, I mean, Sicario is it's a kind of action film, and it's been criticized for painting Mexico in a bad light. But the pacing and also the music. So also the new Blade Runner film is kind of like that. It's the scenes are very slow and drawn out, and then the music's really amazing. And the Dune film the Dune film's a little bit silly, but yeah, I like those films.
So you liked also the second Blade Runner?
Yeah, I like the second Blade Runner. I think it's, I mean, if you see it at the cinema, it's like watching this, everything's got this washed out color palette and the pacing. I like the pacing. And I really appreciate the sound effects. I think if you just watch the original three Star Wars films for the sounds, the way they made the kind of spaceships sound all grungy, like someone had just built it in their garage. It's like, you know, the way the robots sound. I think that the sound makes, I realized after, once you started watching films on Netflix and things, you realize that one of the biggest appeals of going to the theater is the way the sound and the immersive element of that sound, and a really good soundtrack and good sound effects really make a huge difference for me of whether or not I like the film. And I, so Sicario, one of the reasons I like Sicario is the soundtrack's got this droning sound through the whole film, and it just builds the tension the whole way through. There's the scene where they end up flying over the Western US desert. And it's kind of the shot is a drone looking down on this airplane, and it's just going over landscapes, you know, and I love landscapes. And it has this droning sound over the back of the film. And it's really captivating. If you watch that film again, but look out for that scene. I think that scene's amazing. Yeah.
Okay. And I think that's it for our conversation, unless there's something else you want to add or something that you would have liked to discuss or speak about.
Well, I feel as though I didn't say the word Jude enough, because in an email before this podcast, I said I would say it a lot since I grew up saying that in Southern California. And you were going to use AI to turn it into a song.
To turn it into a house
opening. Opening soundtrack, but maybe you can do some house music with what I've said so far and put it on the opening credits.
I'll try. Anyway, it has been fantastic to host you. Thanks a lot for taking the time to answer our questions, and thanks to everyone else for listening. See you soon. Bye bye.